Hello, I'm Richard, and we're Class War Games.
And we're here with our penultimate show of this current season.
Yes, we'll be back at Christmas. We're going to do our top 10 tips for board games for lefties.
Exactly.
But we're going to take a break for a bit.
We've done a good run. We aren't taking a break because actually we've got quite a busy schedule this autumn.
Yes, exactly. And on top of having to do jobs, it's becomes quite a lot, lot to do. So we, of course, we're working up really. I mean, the main thing which we've been promoting across the summer, it's approaching very quickly, is the weekend of the 26th, 27th.
Weekend after next.
Exactly,
actually.
Weekend after next. Saturday, we're doing a participatory gaming session based on Guy Debord's The Game of War.
So if you want to find out a bit more about that,
how to play it,
how to make your own customised.
I mean, if you've bought the Atlas Press English translation, it has a little basic board in the back, but it's quite nice to make your own to give it a bit more graphic flavour.
Yeah, and we're doing a bit of the Marcel Duchamp's with Objet Trouvé as pieces.
And then on the Sunday, the 27th, is the launch of the Class War Games film.
Well, and that has to be a must, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And this is true Guy Debord style. We've made a film out of other people's films.
Exactly.
And at 3 o'clock, the champagne will be broken open.
Exactly, it will be.
And come and champagne socialism, here we come. And then we're going to go off onto our autumn manoeuvres.
Exactly, because you're going to be going off to Rotterdam, aren't you?
But the weekend after, if anyone's there in Rotterdam on Saturday the 3rd, we're going to be at the TAG 004 festival, me and Ilse. Uh-huh. I'm going to be playing the Game of War with Ilse, and Ilse's going to be showing her film.
So
that'll be good. And then the big thing, of course, is November.
Yes, when we're going to have a Baltic link-up.
Yes. I'm going up with Alec Furness, who you might have heard of a few weeks ago when he came in for an interview. We're going up to the Baltic in Newcastle to play the Game of War with Harry Pearson, who we also interviewed on the show recently.
Yes, well, me and Stefan, who was also interviewed on the show, are going to the Baltic. The actual, not the art gallery in Newcastle, but the sea.
Exactly. And what are you doing there?
We're going to the, what's it called?
Lens Politica
in Helsinki, and we'll also be popping over to Estonia as well.
Oh, look at this.
So, but one of the things we're hoping to be able to do is to do a link up between the two Baltics.
And play a game across the hyperspace.
Yeah, so, you know. So, really, we're kind of not going to be doing the radio shows, but we're going to be pretty busy running about here, running about there.
Yeah, and check out on our website, classwargames.net, and it has, you know, current events, future events, all the rest of it.
How do you do board games when you're in different countries?
Well, you have one game in one country and one in the other, and as you move the pieces, each side moves the other side's pieces for it. So you have two games running simultaneously.
How do you link it up?
Well, we'll have Skype and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not like chess players. We don't go bishop to queen's pawn 3.
You can do that in Guy Debord's game. He has put numbers and letters.
Yeah, that's true.
For people who like that sort of thing.
But we're not that advanced yet.
No.
We're getting there. Well, what we're going to do today is we're going to review later on a game that we were being playing over the last couple of weeks on the Happy King Charles. But first, we're going to talk about another gaming experience. You had a really exciting time, I gather, this weekend while I was working away.
Yes. I went to an event organised by some people called Mega Games. And this was in Annerley Town Hall.
Where is that?
Well, I was going to say, if you are familiar with South London, you will know that it's the other side of Penge. So there you go.
How did you get there?
I was able to get there on a train from the London Bridge, which is just actually where we are at the moment.
So what was this mega game then? What does it mean, a mega game? How's it different from board games, war gamings, you know, computer games, all these other things we've been talking about over the summer?
Well, basically what they do is that instead of having, you know, most games you might have, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, but it doesn't usually go up beyond that. Whereas this game, there are over 40 players.
Oh, respect.
And another half dozen people playing different roles. And there'd be like umpires, there'd be political control. One person dealt with the births, deaths and marriages, so, you know, the registrar.
So what was the game about that you were playing?
Well, the game was called Reformation and Renaissance, and it was set in Western Europe. And
so what sort of time is that?
In the 16th century. So it was, for England, it would be in the time of Henry VIII. On this occasion, he didn't actually go Protestant and all that business. He remained...
The Pope learned his lesson from history.
Well, yeah, but it did offend the Holy Roman Empire.
Right, so so this was a sort of role-playing game, was it? An RPG?
Well, no, it was more like the original Kriegsspiel, because it wasn't like, you know, where you have a particular character and you're enhancing all their abilities. You were taking on a particular viewpoint and you were playing that viewpoint.
Did you dress up in Renaissance style for this?
There was one of the players did dress up in a kind of purple. He played in the ecclesiastical role and did actually go from being a cardinal to Pope. So I think dressing up probably worked.
Ah, right. So he looked like a credible person to elect.
Yes, and the other thing was that when the papal election, there was all lots of corruption and you know, one of the cardinals was getting paid by the Lutherans and all this sort of stuff. The person who got elected didn't do any bribing at all.
Oh, they're obviously not going to be an adept at Italian politics then.
Well, I think it was a kind of a manoeuvre which meant that everybody was happy with all right. him because he wasn't too caught up in all the machinations.
And so who was your historical character in this game?
I was playing Margaret of Austria.
Who is she? Or who was she, I should say?
Well, she was actually the viceroy for the Habsburg family in charge of the Netherlands. And in the game, start off at the age of 44, and it's like 4 years a turn in four turns. So you hit 60 soon enough.
And that's very old in that period.
Exactly. And the other thing was, the idea was in that you get given notes about your role, who you should be trying to marry. And I thought, when I noticed that the number of women dying in childbirth, I thought, no, I got a serious offer from the King of England, I have to say. But I thought, nah, I'm going to get me to a nunnery and kind of...
Rather than poxy Henry VIII's bed.
Exactly.
So what were you doing as ruler of the Netherlands? Did you have to go and fight Protestants or burn a few heretics, invade France?
I didn't have to do very much, actually, because I think the Margrave of Baden came up and suppressed the Anabaptists for me. One of the things I did do was I did a bit of matchmaking for the... because what happens in a game like that, the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, he's got too much to do. So I sorted out his marriage to Catherine de' Medici, and that was the main thing I did. And then...
The world-famous poisoner.
Exactly. So, I mean, she actually died. One of the things which emerged from the game was... the game had developed out of the kind of wargaming fraternity, but it had developed much more into the more like diplomacy, with dealing with all those different interactions. And people were quite surprised. Well, there haven't been many battles. And
it's more about personal interaction than it is about actually moving pieces on a board or anything like that.
Yeah.
Or figures across a table or your character across a computer-generated environment.
Yes, and one of the things Brian Cameron, one of the people who basically run the game, says, he says the most exciting bit is the casting. And they've seen how different... Because a lot of the people have been playing it for years, so they know all these people, right? And the person they cast as the King of France was somebody being quite aggressive in a previous game. They thought, oh, that's okay. He'll, like, put the boot in and attack someone. And aside from a little bit of naval battles with the Turks, he didn't really do very much. So people say, oh, there weren't many... battles going on. But one thing, I think something that they'd recently developed was the whole marriages thing, and that there was a lot going on in there, and I think that kind of surprised them a little bit about how active that side of it was. So I think, you know, I think they're in a process of each game they do, they bring in new pieces, they try new things out, and they try and see this kind of group. It was some they've known for years. I think they would make a good, you know.
So, but you were playing a female character, so why didn't they have a woman playing Margaret of Austria?
Well, if you wanted to see a woman, you could go to the little place where they made the teeth. But aside from that, and she did really nice, did sandwiches and teas.
So
and
it was a gender exclusive zone.
It was all men, actually, yeah. Which, I mean, I think that comes from the wargaming origins of it. Because actually, I felt that because the whole dynamics of game was more this personal interaction, it would be the sort of game that would be more appealing to women. But it's just that I don't think...
The group has evolved.
The group has evolved of like a solid male group and from wargaming background. So that's the kind of, that's its heritage. Again, talking to Brian, he said he has done other games in different contexts. He's done games in schools and everything like that. Done games in a commercial environment. Well, they've been quite similar and often there's been like strong female participation. But I think it's to do with the evolution of that particular group. And, probably a lot of them are quite happy that it's that way. They don't,
I think escape from the missus for the weekend. I was just thinking, well, tell us about how the game operates. I mean, you were talking about doing marriages and electing popes and occasional battles. So, I'm just curious, if you don't have a board and you don't have a computer screen and you don't have a table with toy soldiers, how do you know you're winning or losing the game or you're doing something,
Well,
how do you get the feedback?
There were a number of different tables. So they had a table with the main map of Germany. It didn't really have France in it. It had a separate map of France. But it was the main area, and that was the main map. And, in fact, the conflict such that there was took place.
It was the 30 Years' War. That. Well, that's a bit later, though, the 30 Years' War, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's earlier than that, the time of the Italian Wars. Mm. And, in fact, what happened was the Italians, the Sforzas of Milan and the Medicis of Florence, they had all this money, and basically...
Do you get little piles of gold coins, or they're just all tallied up by umpires?
What you got was you got cards, and then you could cash the cards in, and then it would say, like, six plus the roll of one dice. And then they got, like, pennies and spray-painted them silver and... So your pennies and tuppenny pieces.
Now, how do you know if you're winning or losing a game like that? Or is there any...
It's not really about winning or losing. I mean, it's about setting yourself objectives within the historic situation.
So it's more like a reenactment then?
Yes. But within that context, you can certainly see, things are going well. And I mean...
So were you doing well going...
I was part of the Habsburg team, and I'm not sure how well they did. At the end of the game, I'd, become a nun, and the Anabaptists were rioting in the streets, but what do I care? I'm like, sitting in a nunnery.
Waiting to become an Anabaptist.
Well, I was also trying to work out how to become a saint. I never quite got that far, but that was kind of what I was working on. There was one section, in the Annerley Town Hall, there was a stage, and it was up there that there was one person dedicated to doing the birth, deaths and marriages. And there'd be announcements at the beginning of each turn, and he would reel off a list of who'd died, who'd been born and what marriage has taken place. And as I say, the one person who dressed up in like a purple garment with a little mitre who managed to make it to Pope, and he would sit up there reading his papal bulls and everything like that.
Great. So are there photographs of this we can see of you playing...
There are some on the internet. I think we'll have to.
Was it Mega Games?
It's called. Mega Games. Yes. So.
So you didn't dress up, Fabian?
I didn't dress up myself.
I can't really see you in one of those.
Habit. I can.
maybe that's true, actually.
Yes. But yes, I mean, certainly they're doing another game in November, based more on a. I think it's more of a. War game, but it will be a Napoleonic battle with...
That's when we're away, unfortunately, isn't it?
I'm not going to be away.
All right.
You're going to be away. So I'm hoping to go to that, and I think that will be actually quite different, but at the same time, what I think they're trying to do is it's a bit more like the old game of Kriegsspiel, where you say, OK, you're in that room, and your commanding officer in that room, and you're going to get written orders, and the people are running about, and you don't really know what's going on. And then at the end of the game, you have the kind of suddenly everything, all is revealed.
Oh, right, yes. And you suddenly realise you were manoeuvring in completely the wrong direction and this sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the things that happened in this game, that when people went down the pub afterwards, you got people, oh, yeah, oh, that was my plan.
And you realise
all the dodgy dealings that were being done. The Cardinal, like, was getting all this money from the Lutherans to push various objectives forward.
That's the good thing about it. So it's more that diplomacy thing. It's more about the social aspect of gaming.
Yeah, it allows people with Machiavellian minds to really kind of...
Well, I suppose if it's set in the Renaissance, it's a very appropriate.
Exactly, yeah.
So what do you think we could learn class war games from this experience you just went through? I mean, you know, could we use it in our own games, do you think?
I think it's a very powerful tool for if you are trying to understand a particular circumstance or you know, something which involves, you know, quite a complex situation, that you can actually try and play it out, create a model and then try and play it out. It can be fun, it can be instructive, and also you might realise that actually the model you've created isn't, you know, produces some bizarre effect that you hadn't thought of originally.
But if you have an umpire, surely this means you can get over the things like some of the games we've been talking about. They have a set of rules, and then basically people play the rules, not play the game. And I was thinking one of the advantages of having an umpire is that if people start to do that, the umpire can just correct them and make it more historically accurate.
Yes, and that's true. So I think really it's
avoids the gaming the game problem, yeah.
It does. But then again, it also depends on what particular things people are trying to do, like people just like coming up with devious plots just for the sake of it.
Well, I suppose it encourages, isn't it? It's a game. You can indulge in all your fantasies of murdering and poisonings and conquering other people's countries. Or becoming a saint.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, I think certainly if one was, say, you wanted to do a big game about 1919.
Or the poll tax rise.
Yes. I don't know about the poll tax would be...
Well, I was thinking it'd be interesting to do a game like that where you did something like a political campaign of recent history, you know, so where you'd have alliances, you know, I don't know, the 1984-85 miners' strike or...
The miners' strike would be more interesting than the poll tax. The poll tax was...
Rather obvious who was going to win in the long run.
Yeah, but then you could have all sorts of, like, you know, trying to get the other unions to...
Yeah, I mean, that would...
Immingham Dockers, were they going to go on strike or were they going to let the coal be unloaded?
And you... Yes, and Neil Kinnock would lose if the miners won. That was his little sectarian Labour Party comment there. So I think we should definitely try and learn from this experience then of yours and maybe add it into some of the gaming that we're doing down the Flea Pit in our club nights.
I think, well, the thing about the mega games is that it's a big number to organise, but I think having umpire games where you have maybe two or three umpires and don't have a whole 40 players yet. I don't think we're up to that yet. But maybe you say, okay, what we will have is we'll have seven people playing. It will be an umpire game, and you might have one space for the umpires in and one room or people divided up or moving out from other rooms. Whether that work in the Flea Pit or whether we'd need a different kind of spatial configuration so that we could manipulate how people move around,
Right, well, let's try it. We'll try it. Well, that was great. That's really interesting. And as I said, they're called Mega Games. They're on the internet. And if you find their website, you should find somewhere a picture of you as Margaret Orchard.
Yes, I don't know if it's on their website or linked up or...
Something.
Whether it's been made public or just circulated to the players.
But
I did get to see it on somebody's...
Well, we're going to go on to talk about this game that we were playing last night, and we've actually our second attempt to play this game. It's a guy called Charles Vasey, and he's done this game called Unhappy King Charles.
He had his head chopped off. We're talking about Charles the First here, sir.
It's a game of the English Revolution. There's a number of games out there over the last 20, 30 years about this particular subject. Yeah. I must admit, as someone who, very long time ago, when I was like 17, was a reenactor of the English Revolution, as a parliamentarian, of course, I always find these games really exciting, having studied this.
Been to Turnham Green.
Exactly, yes. We were at Turnham Green and we defeated the Royalists again.
Yes.
That sort of thing. So I actually get very excited by games of the English Revolution, and this time round, I was the Parliament, and I was doing really well until lots of people came and distracted us from finishing it and saved King Charles's head.
Well, that's obviously a matter of opinion. We need to go into that.
So good. So let's talk about the game. The game itself is very well produced. It's done by, actually, it's an American company, GMT Games. The map is beautiful, actually.
It is. And, I mean, one of the things that looking at it, immediately one is drawn to compare it to Kingmaker.
Yes, because it's another civil war in England and Wales.
Exactly. So it's the same area, but it's handled in a very different way.
Yeah, and I think, obviously, in 30 years, graphic design in board games has improved remarkably.
Yes, I mean, it really looks good.
Yeah.
And actually, that means playing the game is a more pleasurable experience.
But as we know from, you know, our experience with Triumph of Chaos, having a really beautiful board doesn't necessarily make a very good game.
No.
I mean, this is quite similar in a way to Triumph of Chaos, because it's a board game and it has pieces, but it also has cards that actually drive the movement of the game.
That's right.
And it has a very big rule book and a very big play guide as well.
Yes. I mean, I found the rules more manageable than some games, but I don't think we quite got to the full extent of the rules. I think we were getting...
Well, I think the first time we played it, we basically got it wrong, didn't we? Because we spent our time fighting battles, when actually the point of the game really is to seize territory.
Exactly.
Which is more realistic. So you go around and you have local notables and you have these little counters which you can flip over to either be orange for Parliament or blue for the King.
Yes, and then some are just empty spaces.
And you try and fill them out. And the objective of the game is at certain points, when you get to about halfway through the game, you can actually work out who's winning or losing, because by just counting up the number of points that they've secured.
Yes, I'm sure if we'd done that, we'd have found that I was winning, but, you know, and then get that far.
I could say the other way. Once you lost Wales and the North, you know, that was it. You know, the King was doomed. But I thought that was quite good. Once we actually got that it wasn't really about fighting battles, that they're just a means to win, I thought that made the game a lot more interesting. And it is quite realistic. If you know anything about the history of the game, the game we played last night was very much like the history of the war, that the King starts quite strongly, grabs a lot of territory in the centre of the board, and then slowly over time the Parliament gets more powerful, particularly when the Scots come in, and slowly whittles down the King. And I assume if we'd gone on long enough, the Parliament almost inevitably wins, because their long-term power of controlling London should play out.
Yes, I mean, I just thought of trying going for London, but I would have had to give up everything else. Obviously, if the King gets London, that is a big, big step forward. Because
it was the centre of the country, like now.
Exactly.
But these cards are great. I thought the cards were good. I mean, because what you do is you get this core card, as they call it. So you always can move twice per your go. What you do is you basically have a hand of six cards for each round, and you play alternate cards. And it allows, and you have, as I said, these ones where you allow you to do things like move your army or do a raid and convert some territory or recruit people. And then you have these nice funny cards. So there's one like Lord Strange declares to the King, and this means that in the Manchester area goes Parliament, because obviously he was a very unpopular local notable.
Right, yes. It's interesting that the way they do it, they divided it up into the early war, the mid war, and the late war, so that you've got three different decks, and the cards are shuffled. So I was the royalist, but so if I had a really good parliamentary card, I just use it to get reinforcements.
Yeah, you're doing is discarding it.
Yes, so I'm stopping the parliamentarian from having the benefit of the card. And then, so with the ones that are more useful to me, like King's Lynn Rising, I would play as a card in itself.
And I thought I had the East, and suddenly I have to rush troops back to deal with a royalist revolt.
Exactly. So I think that side of it worked, because your own cards was great, and even discarding a card that would be really good for the other player felt quite good as well.
Yeah, and you can sort of keep cards in a sort of what's called an ace in the hole, so you have like one spare card.
Well, this is a disputed thing, because I wanted to keep raising the royal standard.
He wanted to put off starting the war as long as possible. Well, that's not allowed. I had a great one there called...
Arguments.
Yes, well, if you go to the Facebook page, you can see Fabian studying the rule book, looking for the rule that will make him win the game. But they do have other cards like, you know, psalm singing. So I know when you attacked me and I had this card, so I could put down in there, and all my troops sang away and managed to hold you off for another round.
Exactly. It really captures the spirit of the age.
Yeah. But I thought, in a way, the cards are very good, because they do actually drive the narrative. So, you know, the royal standard does have to be raised in the first move to start the war, and the Scots do come in 1640. 1943, and the new model army is formed in 1644. But I thought that was
the mandatory cards.
They're the mandatory cards,
and they happen in each phase.
Yes, but I thought the problem with the game is, in some ways, it's too realistic. I would imagine if you played this 10 or 20 times, it would be very similar, where as I said, you have this basic thing that the parliament is strong in one area, and this area the king is strong in here. He's going to build up at the beginning, and then the other side's going to whip him down. And when the Scots come in, so it might make the game quite repetitive, if accurate.
Well, and then that touches on another thing, because I think you'd have to play the game three or four times to really get your head around the rules. And maybe by the time you played it three or four times, you realise that actually there's quite a, you know. It's quite clear what's going to happen, and it is going to be repetitive. So by the time you've actually equipped yourself with all the skills needed to play the game without spending all your time leafing through the rules, you've actually lost interest in the game.
Yeah, because I think there were sort of unnecessary complications in the rules. I mean, they had this gate. You know, you had a figure called Waller outside Plymouth, and he can't move in until the royal standard raised. There's lots of rules like that. I felt they just could have been got rid of, which are unnecessary to the operation of the game. They'd make it look more realistic.
I think there are, for some people, these sort of Baroque flourishes. They like them, even though both of us find them a little bit irritating. And you were talking about the difference between the American gaming and the Euro game.
Yes, there's an interview, interesting, with Charles Vasian. He says that there's these two types, the ones which move easily, he calls theme light, and then these American ones, which are very heavy and take a long time to play. Yeah. And he wanted to go in the middle between the two, the Goldilocks formula. And I actually think he's veered in parts too much towards the American style. That in a way, I think we're definitely Euro gamers on this.
And I think you're right there. And
I think it's interesting thinking about Kingmaker, because Kingmaker, I think works much better. I mean, it reproduces medieval warfare easily, and it's very quick to pick up. I mean, Stefan, who was here last week, as he said, he'd never played the game before, but within two rounds, he was in the game.
Yes.
And it is reasonably complicated, but it's not unnecessarily complicated.
It's fluid and it's intuitive, whereas this game was a little bit clunky.
And you have to look up rule 6.5 to do something. And I think that's part of the problem. If you could actually get more of the information onto the cards and actually make it simpler, actually in a way it would be more realistic.
Well, this is what we're working on our game, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Really. And I mean, this was one of the games we did learn from.
Well, we've got cards, event cards, using. I would recommend it, definitely, to try out.
Yes. Anyway, we're coming to the end of the show now.
Yes, listen. Oh, it's our final show next week.
Yes, so, make sure you...
And we're going to have our first woman guest.
Yes.
Ilse Black, the director of the Class War Games film, will be here.
Yes.
And then you just have to wait till Christmas for our top 10 board games.
Yes, and we'll probably update you on our little adventures going hither and thither during the autumn as well.
And we'll share a glass of champagne with Sarah, I hope, then. Okay, thank you for listening.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
As always, guys, see you next week.
De Boer, strategist for the Situationist International, developed the Game of War whilst in exile after the May 68 revolution. On Saturday the 26th of September, the Class War Games crew present Marcel Duchamp meets Blue Peter, a day of making and playing De Boer's game. Join them in redefining political and contextual territories and learn how to fight the oppressors of the spectacular society. Sunday brings the launch of the Class War Games film, The Game of War, directed by Ilse Black and written by Richard Barbrook and Fabian Thompson. For more information about Class War Games and players, visit classwargames.net.